We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning is Jason Croft. Today, we open the phone lines and the email message folder for questions about diet and nutrition. Our guest is licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. And listeners, we look forward to your phone calls and email messages this morning for Susan. Here are the phone numbers. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. Susan, who is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips, is also the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics, and she leads nutrition and cooking classes at the Activities and Recreation Center on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Again, listeners, questions, comments about diet and nutrition are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455, the number if you're outside the local area code. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back, Susan.
Good morning. It's a beautiful morning.
Oh, isn't it lovely?
Just it sure is.
Gorgeous. We're going to get up to the low 70s today, I think.
It's amazing.
Lots of sunshine.
Yes.
So, how are you?
I'm good. I guess we're getting close to ready for the holidays.
I know. Winter will be here soon.
It will be.
So what are your strategies when it comes to healthy holiday eating? Because there are certainly so many temptations out there.
Right. Well, actually, it's a really good time to be talking about it because a few weeks before we start this holiday rush and holiday eating scenarios, it's a good time to kind of think ahead. So I'd say that's probably one of the first things to think about if you're trying to, you know, maintain weight. I really never recommend anybody try to lose weight over the holidays. Occasionally people can do that if they have more time and they're working out or they happen to be able to go on a trip and exercise a lot or something like that. But it's a good bet to just try to maintain if you've been trying to lose weight or been just trying to eat healthy. Use it as a time to maintain, but not necessarily worry about losing weight because there are a lot of unusual things happening during the holidays. But thinking ahead is really important because when we do that, we can plan ahead when we shop. We can make sure that we're still trying to balance out our eating. And that's probably one of the most important things. I'd say if there was one thing, our listeners would do during the holidays, it would be to buy more produce and eat more produce, simply because a lot of things we eat during the holidays would be extra sweets and extra starches, and we might have meals that have two kinds of potatoes and corn and bread and all these starches that we wouldn't normally eat together. But if we really try to stay up on really focused on making sure there's fruit and vegetable at the meals, making sure you're eating a little bit more before the meals in terms of an extra apple, even the simple things of trying to kind of get yourself a little more fiber and filled up, we just won't eat as much. And so that's number one. Have the produce around simply because we tend to shift that out of our diet for a while and eat more sweets and desserts and candies. And I mean, even starting in Halloween, because certainly we just have had more candy around, even though a lot of it got taken to work that was left over. But still, you have these things around that you might not normally be munching on those candy pumpkins and things like that that you do during this time of year. So as much as you can try to curb that sweet tooth a little bit with fruit as well, I think is really helpful. So that's probably number one. And the second thing is to really be aware of portions, because I'm sure most of us have felt after a holiday meal, whoa, I can't believe I ate all that, or I really didn't need all that, or I didn't really want all that, but you just ate it because it was there. So one way to do that, if you're hosting the meal, is to start out with plates that aren't quite so big. Another thing you can do is make sure that there are three or four options that really are healthy. There are a lot of recipes coming out now, and we can talk about some of those today that offer some good alternatives. And just the idea of offering extra vegetables, you know, for example, at a Thanksgiving meal, maybe offer, I've got a good recipe today we can talk about with some Brussels sprouts that are really good but not that high in calorie. And maybe you have those and green beans. And for appetizer, you have a fruit kebab, which is recommended in one of the things we'll talk about today, as opposed to cheese and crackers or something like that. So by the time you actually eat the meal, you've got three or four servings of vegetables. And you still can have everything else, but you're just not going to eat as much of them.
Okay. Let's talk with a caller now. We have a listener waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Very good topic. Thanks for speaking today. My question is about roasting vegetables. I know that lots of people like to do it, and I'm wondering what this does to the nutritional value of vegetables.
Well, when you roast vegetables, and the main way that I like to roast vegetables is just chop up a bunch of fresh veggies. Maybe you've got broccoli, carrots, cauliflower, sweet potatoes, whatever you might have, onions, and drizzle a little bit of olive oil on there, maybe some salt and pepper, other spices, and then just roast them that way. Generally, they're roasted at a pretty high temperature, 400 or so, maybe even more, 450, for not that long of a time. And what happens when you do that is that some of the nutrients, let's say, for example, the vitamin A you might think of in the sweet potatoes, some of the nutrients when the food is mixed with some fat, like a little bit of olive oil, those nutrients are actually a little bit better absorbed. So you may actually get more of certain vitamins and minerals out of it. Other nutrients, like vitamin C and some others, when food is heated, some of those nutrients are oxidized, and the heat might make it so that you don't absorb as many of those. But I think overall, I would never worry about whether you're cutting down on a lot of the nutrition if you roast vegetables, because you're basically going to get some that you might have more nutrients come out of and others not, but it's still a really highly nutritious way to eat vegetables. The other thing for a lot of people is they can end up eating them a little bit more easily, because particularly things like broccoli and cauliflower and foods that might be real gassy if you eat them fresh, once they're cooked and particularly once they're roasted a little bit and some of that is broken down, they're a lot more digestible. So I think there's pros and cons whenever you cook vegetables But we do know that the olive oil, particularly if you use that, is a good fat. It's healthy. So what you might end up doing is getting a real good balance of nutrients, more vitamin E and other good fats for the body when you roast them. And I find that a lot of people will eat more vegetables if that's an option, because they kind of taste, they get a little bit sweeter. They sometimes even caramelize a little bit. And some people will say, well, gosh, I wouldn't probably eat that raw broccoli, but boy, is that good once it's roasted.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's take another call now. A listener in Monticello, line two. Hi.
Hi. I just tuned in, and you're talking about fruits and vegetables, are you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got this art magazine, this latest issue. They have an article in there, or it's not really an article. It's just a small insert, and they say that the percentage of adults daily consuming fruits and vegetables, and they give a data, how many adults are consuming fruits and vegetables each day in each state and in D.C. And the highest percentage of people, they say, that are consuming fruits and vegetables every day is 20% in D.C., and the lowest is in Oklahoma, 9.3%. I just can't fathom that that's all the people that are eating fruits and vegetables. Or no, Mississippi has 8.8% of adults that consume fruits and vegetables daily. Can that be right?
Well, I'm wondering if that is consuming any fruits and vegetables or consuming the recommended amount of fruits and vegetables. Does it say?
Well, It's not very explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
It says daily consumption is two or more fruits and three or more vegetables.
Okay.
So maybe that's just it. I don't know. But
yeah.
It just seems like the numbers are just astounding.
Well, I think what it probably is like you're saying, two or more fruits, three or more veggies a day, a five-a-day serving or something that we would think about, that makes sense to me, that perhaps only 20%
uh-huh.
of most people
will eat
or less, right, are eating that number of servings. And that's a real, obviously, that's a real problem. So the idea of trying to really focus on eating more produce, I mean, we talk about it. We hear about the five a day. We hear about more produce. We hear about trying to bump that up. And there are many, many studies, of course, that link higher intake of fruits and vegetables, particularly vegetables, with lower incidence of heart disease and certain cancers and diabetes and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
I think the big thing is the accessibility. We know for some people that's one of the big problems, is they live in areas where they're not very accessible and the groceries that are available are not very healthy. And so that's a problem that certainly is being researched now and addressed and those kinds of things. But that's one issue. And I think the other issue is just not having family meals, because, you know, when we sit down to a family meal, or when I remember having family meals too, we usually had one or two vegetables, and we maybe had a fruit too, or a fruit for dessert. Or, and so this whole idea of like the Family Resiliency Center here and different places and different groups trying to really talk about the importance of sitting down to a family meal, even if it's short, or making sure your kids understand what a balanced meal is. And this type of education I do a lot with our college athletes, really sitting down and looking at a plate and dividing it into fourths and making sure two-fourths of that plate is produce. You've got a vegetable, you've got a fruit at every meal, eating in the dining hall, those kinds of things. And even for a lot of our students who are coming to campus, they're just not used to eating that way. And so it's really important to do that. I really applaud a lot of the schools that are trying to implement some of these programs, in the grade schools in particular, where they're bringing in healthy snacks and they're trying different kinds of fruits and they're doing vegetables, and extensions doing a lot of this wonderful work too. That's really helpful, because then kids start seeing that, oh, I guess a snack would normally include a fruit. I better make sure I have one, or this is normal to eat for me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's helpful.
Well, a lot of the states that have very low percentage are in the South too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so maybe it's I don't know what would cause that, but
yeah, well,
probably
I think
lack of education.
Yeah, and socioeconomic status.
I mean,
there's no question that
more poor people.
Right. So I think it's a matter of educating about it, but really accessibility is a huge factor.
Do they consider like French fries, would that be a vegetable?
Well, French fries and some of our recommendations are considered in the vegetable category, but most of these studies, they really don't, because a fried potato really is a starch. And so that skewed a lot of the early research that counted French fries as vegetables, but really you can't necessarily count that as a high-quality serving.
No. Okay. All right. Well, thanks.
You're very welcome. This is Focus, and our guest this morning in this hour of the program is Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. And listeners, you're invited to join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We talk about diet and nutrition with licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat once a month here on Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, we've got an email question for you, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Would you discuss maximizing calcium intake in postmenopausal women?
Well, calcium, of course, is a big concern, is a big issue. And when we, you know, as we get older in general, both men and women, we tend to lose the ability to absorb calcium as well. We certainly absorb it, but we don't absorb it as well, like a lot of nutrients. And, of course, we're naturally losing bone mass as we get older. Obviously, one of the, you know, the maximizing calcium, some of the things we think about are making sure you're getting enough, and not everyone agrees on the recommendations for calcium, but anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500, maybe even a little bit more, milligrams per day of calcium. So part of it is getting enough calcium. For most of us, that's 4 servings of a high-calcium food a day, which many times when I work with clients, I'll say, oh, yeah, I get that. But then when I start looking at food logs, most people are not getting that. That would be a cup of milk or an ounce of cheese or half cup of cottage cheese or a cup of yogurt or a cup of calcium-fortified orange juice and those kinds of things. So if you use milk products, you're much more apt, obviously, to get the calcium. If you don't use milk products and you're choosing other foods like greens, which are high, spinach, some nuts, tofu, things like that, that's helpful too. They're just not going to be absorbed as well, and there's not as much calcium in there. So I guess one way to maximize calcium is to get enough. And so if you really don't think you're getting enough, you probably do want to get one or two calcium supplements a day. There are many types of calcium. A lot of times they have magnesium in them and some other nutrients as well. But getting 500 or 600 milligrams of calcium once or twice a day with vitamin D too is generally a really good idea if you're not coming close. So that would be the second thing I'd say. Make sure your levels are high enough, first of all. And we do know if you take calcium in, again, with vitamin D and perhaps with magnesium and some other vitamin K and some other nutrients, then it's absorbed a little bit better. So the way we would do that in food may be a food that naturally has D added, like milk, for example, where you have calcium, you have vitamin D added. Soy milk or some of these other milk products or milk substitutes would have calcium and vitamin D added. And so do a day-long diet log or a couple days and just write down everything you're eating and seeing, gosh, am I getting enough nutrients? We've mentioned before on this program that anyone, if they have access to the internet, could actually go online. And an easy way to, there are many, many analysis tools, but one of the ones that I like is the nutrition analysis tool that was originally developed here at the University of Illinois. And that one is just nat.uiuc.edu. And you could go to the NAT version 2 when you get in there and just put in your information, and you could log in what you've eaten for a couple days to see what comes up. So I guess that's number one, make sure you're getting enough. And then looking at ways to say, well, I'm getting a high calcium food, but I'm also getting vitamin D with it. For many people, I would certainly recommend having their vitamin D levels checked, because if you're eating enough calcium but your D levels are low, you're not maximizing calcium absorption. So you want to make sure your D levels are normal. That's just a blood test that can be done. And I think everybody should have that done periodically to see, because so many people are low. And then the other thing I would think about too is looking at other things you might be eating that decrease calcium absorption. So for example, if you take in a lot of coffee or tea, caffeine can decrease calcium absorption, and the tannins can decrease calcium absorption. So if you're one of these people who drink 5 or 6, 7 cups of coffee or tea a day, you may not be maximizing your calcium absorption simply because of that. The other thing I would say is that if you're taking calcium in and it's in a multivitamin form, you really don't want iron in that form either. Now, generally postmenopausal women wouldn't be taking iron necessarily anyway, but I've noticed so many multivitamins now have added calcium, but they also have 100% iron, and they're both big minerals. So when you take those together, it's really not ideal. You decrease absorption of both of those minerals because they kind of compete for binding. Mm-hmm. So that would be another thing I'd look at. Sometimes people say, well, my multi has calcium in it, so I'm really not worried. But even though it has 400 milligrams or something, it's got a full 100% of iron, so we don't probably think we'll absorb as much of that. So, and I think the other thing is to have calcium throughout the day. That's another way to maximize it, not just depend on having yogurt and milk at breakfast and then maybe something else, but spreading it out throughout the day.
Okay. So I think typically it's easy to get in some calcium and vitamin D at breakfast because there you've got, you know, milk. You could have calcium fortified and vitamin D fortified, orange juice and the like. But maybe then you want to hold off on having that coffee for a little while?
Well, or even just have a cup or two. I mean, okay. I guess I'm not an expert on exactly how much you would take in to cause a problem, but even if you're kind of thinking that you're not going to go overboard on it throughout the day or it's not in your system all the time, that may be helpful. That may be beneficial. Same thing with just caffeine in general. But like you say, breakfast may be a pretty easy time to get that in. But then remembering, maybe a snack could be a high calcium snack like a yogurt or even a glass of soy milk or chocolate soy milk, which a lot of people like, and that's fortified in
or
a good...
some low-fat cheese.
Right, low-fat cheese, too. We could add the cheese to fruit. Maybe have a sliced apple with a little low-fat cheese, and then we'd be doing everything.
And look out. We here in Illinois will have our vegetable and fruit intake up.
That's right.
What is the role of exercise in terms of bone strength and calcium and vitamin D uptake?
Right. Well, we know that if you're exercising, you certainly maintain bone strength better. We maintain our stronger bone density, and particularly with doing a combination of exercise. So anytime I have a client who this is maybe an issue for them, they've had stress fractures or they have osteoporosis or things like that, they really want to be on a sound exercise program where they're getting some bone-bearing exercise, particularly light weights or working with weights anyway, as well as walking if they can do it, or some type of exercise where you're actually moving your body. So we do know that exercise plays a huge role in maintaining bone strength too. I mean, we naturally start losing it 20s, 30s. We're just gradually losing bone density. So one of the goals is to try to minimize that loss. We may not necessarily build it, but if we can minimize that loss, then that's really, really helpful. And I think what happens to a lot of people is we really don't pay that much attention to it till we get to where we have osteoporosis. And then it's really more difficult. Again, you can try to still minimize the loss, but it's much better early on to try to start preventing that. And one thing I see is a lot of college students coming in where they just don't drink milk anymore. Maybe they just started drinking a lot more soda or coffee or other things, and they just really don't. Many of them will tell me, I like it. I like soy milk. I like regular milk. I like chocolate milk. I like these things. I just hardly ever eat them or drink them. So I think we still have to keep that education going and trying to get more calcium in many different sources for kids early on.
Yeah, it's tough, you know, in terms of availability if you're, you know, on the run, so to speak. And students are very busy people.
Right.
And, you know, you come across soda machines everywhere, but getting a glass of milk is, you gotta look for it.
Right, and it may not be as cool. I mean, that's one thing I tell a lot of my athletes. If you're going to go, let's say, to McDonald's or a place like that, just remember you can always order milk and chocolate milk there too, partly for the calcium, but partly just because it's a great protein source. So remembering that we can make those choices. But that's where things like even string cheese, or there are a lot of cereals that are calcium fortified. Again, they may have iron too, so that may be a bit of an issue. But looking for snacks that also have more calcium, or calcium fortified breads now, or things like that that make it a little bit easier.
This is Focus. Our guest this morning is dietitian Susan Kundrat. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us on the phone, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. This is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. A caller has left a question with our technical director. What do you think is a satisfactory level of vitamin D? And I don't know if this is in terms of daily intake or in terms of what your blood test should show.
Well, with vitamin D levels, I think the norm, I guess I don't have it offhand what the actual levels are. I would start with saying in food, or what we want to try to get in the diet, we generally think of 200 IUs of vitamin E, vitamin D, but most people really do need more than that. And again, it's kind of hard to tell if you don't know, you know, your own levels here. But generally, if something's fortified, it might have 200 IUs in it, or 400 IUs even for many things. There are recommendations now that are coming out saying, well, it's probably better to get 1,000 IUs a day in food if you're looking at different options for different foods. One thing we know about vitamin D is that there is a tolerable upper limit of what you should take in, and that's about 2,000 IUs a day. However, if someone is low, if their blood levels show that they are low, then they would probably be recommended to take in a lot more than that. Some people certainly need more, up to 5,000 IUs or 10,000 IUs or even more to take that in. I'm trying to find the actual levels in the body. I guess I'm not going to say the number because I can't remember exactly what it is, but that would be on the test that you would get, and would show.
And your physician would be able to talk with you about that and say, well, you're a little low, so we're going to do this to address that issue.
Right, to get your normal range. What I would say about levels is that in a few conferences I've been to and when I've listened to experts on vitamin D and people who research this topic, a theme that kind of comes out a lot is that even if you're at the very low end, that might not be okay. And so let's say when you get your range back, it would be worth putting a call into your physician, even if it says, well, you're normal, but you're way down at the low end of normal. Because, you know, there's some thought that being in the normal range but way low is still not really optimal, that you want your vitamin D levels more towards the middle or up a little bit. So it might be one of those nutrients that the low end is not really the best place to be. And we just tend to have a lot of people with low vitamin D in this area because we don't get the type of strong sunlight that you get, let's say, if you're living in Florida or something like that, and we don't have that many days of it. And so it's not, you know, it's not uncommon to have low vitamin D levels. And not only that that's related to calcium and uptake and bone strength, but now we're learning that it may be related to other disease states, certain types of cancer and other things if your levels are low.
Also, do I have this correct that there might be some link between vitamin D or a lack of vitamin D and inflammation?
Yes, I think there have been some studies looking at that too. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, all the time there are new things coming out about vitamin D and what it's linked to, and it just wasn't a vitamin that was, I'm sure it was studied well, but maybe not in the way that we're looking at it now and related to a lot of these disease states. So I think there are many, many roles vitamin D plays, and, you know, it's I'm sure we'll learn a lot more about it because it's being looked at a lot more closely. But
will there be a new recommendation, do you think, coming out from the government?
Well, I think that the recommendation, I mean, I'm not an expert on that in terms of the public policy, but I know that there are just a lot of people pushing for higher levels of vitamin D, kind of similar to protein, where a lot of people are, a lot of experts are pushing for a little bit higher levels of protein, particularly as we get older, looking at our national recommendations to go up a little bit. So those are always tricky things because, you know, sometimes those recommendations are based on getting most people just in the range, but not necessarily optimal. And so sometimes you have to take it a step further, even if that is the national recommendation.
Okay, very good. Well, we've got a couple of listeners waiting for us on the telephone. Let's go next to Lafayette, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Hello. Can you give us some idea of the acceptable overall level of vitamin C? I've heard anything from thousands of units down to mere hundreds, claiming that the body can't use more than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, vitamin C is another vitamin that's controversial. A lot of people believe a lot of different things. But, you know, if we look at our general recommendations, they're anywhere from 60 milligrams a day to maybe 100 milligrams a day or 150, depending on if you're a smoker or not. If you're a smoker, generally we recommend more because of the oxidative state that your body's in as a smoker. But, you know, personally, I would say that we don't have a lot of evidence to say for sure that these mega doses of over 2,000 milligrams a day or, you know, maybe even way more than that are going to be beneficial. There are people who believe this, and there are, you know, researchers that really believe that that level or above is helpful. The problem that I see with that is we do have some research to indicate that consistently if you're taking in these large doses of certain vitamins and minerals, even if it's water-soluble like vitamin C, that it actually might work as a pro-oxidant or begin to cause damage in the body if you've got these large amounts of nutrients. And so a safe level that I would see, you know, if we think about 100 milligrams or something being kind of around the recommendation, I would see no problem with people, you know, utilizing maybe even 10 times that amount, maybe even up to 1,000 milligrams. But over that, you probably need to have a real reason that you would be taking it and a reason that you're using it. Certainly in certain cases, sometimes people with certain cancers, depending upon who they're working with, they might recommend alternative ways of looking at nutrition using large amounts and that kind of thing. But whether that's really substantiated is questionable. Certainly some, you know, some people may believe that it is. But I think for general health, anywhere from, you know, 100 milligrams a day to 500 to maybe even 1,000 milligrams a day.
Should we divide it up into several times a day?
Right. Divide it up into several times. And I've seen research to indicate that maybe 200 or 300 milligrams at a time if you're going to take it, or a 250 milligram tablet if you take vitamin C is a reasonable amount to take, because just as you mentioned, keeping blood levels at a good level but not way too much that your body just gets rid of it is helpful. So
like 100 or 200 a couple times a day.
Right. Or obviously if you're eating more produce, more fruits and vegetables, more foods high in vitamin C, many people I find if they're eating well, they can get 500, 600, 700 milligrams of vitamin C a day in food. Because they're eating things like oranges and orange juice and broccoli and strawberries and different fruits and vegetables, that potatoes that are high in vitamin C. And so it's really doable at least to get 500 milligrams a day in food if you're eating well. But if you're taking a supplement, probably the most I'd recommend at one time is 500 milligrams. Or you may see people taking things like the packs that have kind of a powdered vitamin C that's 1,000 milligrams a day. I usually tell people to break that down into two servings. Maybe don't take it all at one time, just break it down. So they maybe don't have to eat it four times a day, but at least twice a day to break it down somewhat.
So 1 or 2 thousand would be safe for the day?
Well, I would do 1 or 2 servings of 500 if you wanted to supplement. And many of those packs that you find, like Emergency and some of these other things, generally have 1,000 milligrams, but I would just have half of that twice a day.
Okay.
And that's a way that you've bumped it up, you've increased it, but you're not at the levels that we think might be problematic. The upper level that's recommended in general health is this 2,000 milligrams, and above that, for some people, that'll cause problems like diarrhea and other things. So, you know, for me personally, I would be quite comfortable with 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day to give extra, but, you know, not necessarily over that unless there is a real reason to do that.
In a couple of servings.
Right, right, okay. Breaking it down, and within food. So it might be that your food, if you're a good eater, you might get 400 or 500 milligrams in food, and you might have one other, you know, half a packet a day or something, or 500 milligram, you know, 250 to 500 milligram supplement, and that would be very reasonable, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to say something or ask you a question about vitamin D also and sleep. I've been a bad sleeper for a number of years. And a few years ago, I had to take, finally, after doing much reading about sleeping online and in books and everywhere, talking to people, nothing really helped to sustain my sleep, so I had to resort to a prescribed sleep medication. And then a few years ago, just out of the blue, spontaneously, I started sleeping. You know, so naturally, for the next few months, I tried to recreate anything I had done during that time period to bring the sleep back, but it didn't work. And about 15 months later, I had the same experience. I just spontaneously started sleeping. And I'm a strong believer that if you, you know, your body starts doing something, you know, there's a reason, and mm-hmm. you can figure it out. And I realized that the one thing that I had been, that was in common with both periods, I was a student out at Parkland both times. I'd been taking walks. I like to go out for walks. I would walk around Parkland sometimes in my hour between classes. And, of course, Parkland doesn't have a lot of trees. I don't like sunblock, so I wasn't wearing sunblock. And it was warm weather. I was wearing a tank top. So I was getting a bit of sunshine. And I also have various things I can't eat because they make me feel unwell. So I didn't eat any dairy products, and I didn't take any supplements. So, you know, I think I wasn't getting very much vitamin D in my diet. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, sunshine, maybe I'm getting vitamin D now. Maybe vitamin D is what's making me sleep. It rained for the entire next month, so I couldn't keep up the walking, and eventually the sleep went away. So I tried a vitamin D supplement, and those make me feel pretty ill, actually. And I am not recommending this to anybody, but this was just to confirm that it might have had something to do with the vitamin D. You know, I tried going to a tanning salon just for a few minutes a week, no more than 10 minutes a week, split up over a few sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually did bring my sleep back. I don't know if the exposure to the, you know, sunlight or the UVB radiation is doing something else for me, but I wondered if it might be the vitamin D. And I have looked extensively for connections between vitamin D and sleep. You know, and I've never seen anything Mm-hmm. You know, you see calcium mentioned often,
mm-hmm.
But you don't see anything about vitamin D. But, it, you know, I wondered if you had ever heard anything about that.
Well, I haven't, but it is, I mean, certainly it's possible. I mean, I guess I would think of a couple things, but the first thing that came to mind is getting more exercise, because we know that if you generally get more exercise and activity, most people sleep better.
I exercised regularly before that already.
Oh, okay.
This was just being outside,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a tank top with no sunblock.
Sure,
was
sure.
One difference. I did exercise regularly. I walked the same amount.
Yeah.
Either in shade or with long sleeves on or inside on a treadmill.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that's not necessarily it. But, you know, it is possible. I'm not aware of research linking vitamin D to sleep. But like I said, yeah. I think this is an area where a lot of people are studying vitamin D now. So just like any other nutrient, it may be that we find out a lot more in the next few years. So it's going to make me look it up, though, now that you say that, to see if I can find anything coming out as well, because obviously for you, something was going on, and it was something, it seems to be possibly related to that.
Yeah, it really does seem to, you know, somehow be related to the UVB radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope somebody looks into it, because I, you know, I'm wondering if there are other sleepless people out there.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of sleepless people.
Well, yes, I gather that from all mm-hmm. the ads on TV for Lunesta and Ambien.
mm-hmm.
And, I hope so. And I also wanted to mention that, you know, what some people might not realize with their vitamin D, and I certainly didn't before that. You know, I think my main source for vitamin D before, for most of my life, had probably been dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you stop eating dairy products, you may, if you don't take a supplement, you may be losing your vitamin D.
Right.
So I think a lot of people might not realize that. So I just wanted to mention that. I certainly didn't, you know, realize that until this all came back. That
mm-hmm.
I was. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks
for the call this morning. Somewhere I recall someone saying that fresh air and green spaces are important to our overall health and how we're sleeping.
Yeah. Well, I think that is certainly something that can help a lot of people, being outside and breathing fresh air and seeing beauty and those kinds of things, too, and relaxing maybe more.
Yeah, yeah. So a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and maybe it all adds up to a good night's sleep.
That's right.
Well, we have another email question, Susan. This is from a listener who wants to know, why is vitamin C measured in milligrams while vitamin D is measured in IU? And I think that's international units. Is that what that stands for?
Yes. Well, it's confusing. I don't know exactly why originally they're measured differently like that. I'm sure if there's an expert in vitamins listening, they could probably tell us exactly. But one of the things with vitamin D, sometimes you'll find vitamin D listed in micrograms, too, because vitamin D, it's in a much smaller unit. So 2,000 IUs is the same as 50 micrograms a day. And so you may see it in that as well. Of course, micrograms is considerably smaller than milligrams. But I guess it maybe is just the size of the particle or the size of the component or size of the vitamin itself or components in the vitamin that make it that way. But I don't know why that was chosen in terms of a unit, personally.
Yeah. This is Focus, and our guest this morning is licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email with questions, comments about diet and nutrition. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She is also the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with us this morning. Toll-free 800-222-9455, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. No one waiting at the moment. No, we've got a call coming in on line one. So rather than launching into another topic, why don't we get this person on the air? Susan, also let me mention, is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips, and you'll find her on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Well, that caller fell away.
Okay.
So I wanted to go back to the holiday question that we started out with. You know, there's so many temptations, and you might find yourself going from one party to the next.
Or right.
There's something always wonderful at work laid out for you in the break room, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And you said that you brought a recipe along. You want to share something short and sweet with us?
Sure. Well, what I will share, first of all, is, you know, one of the things about holiday, I guess, holiday eating, and if we go towards the meals very briefly, the interesting thing is just how much we can eat at a meal. How much do you think a typical Thanksgiving meal would be calorie-wise? Any idea?
Oh, it's got to be like 2,500 maybe.
Yeah.
Am I in the ballpark?
You're in the ballpark. This was looked at closely some years back with the Cleveland Clinic Heart Institute there, or the heart, their cardiovascular area. And they looked at a typical meal. And, of course, this was only what I thought was interesting, 3 ounces of turkey, which, of course, at Thanksgiving, many people eat much more than that. And it was about 2,100 calories for a typical meal. And we kind of went through what a typical meal looks like. And then what they did is kind of changed that meal and modified it in a healthy way. Even simple things like eating white meat turkey and only using a little bit of gravy. And then they've got several recipes that I brought too that give different options for making some side dishes and those kinds of things. And the meal that is still a good amount of food, actually quite tasty, and the recipes look great, ended up being about 772 calories.
Much better.
Much better. So about a third of the calories, if you are paying attention to how things are prepared and what you're eating, and not even really, this didn't even really change a lot of the amounts of what folks ate. It was more what the recipes look like.
Yeah, I found some tips that were really interesting before the show today, because this was something that we decided we would talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And one suggestion, for example, very simple for your dressing, use less bread, a little less bread, and add more onions, garlic, celery, and vegetables, add fruits. So that's really easy to do.
Yeah.
On the gravy, refrigerate it. You know, maybe make it a day ahead. Refrigerate it. Skim the fat off the top. And then the other thing that I found that was really interesting, and I've heard that this works really well, and we're not big dessert eaters at our house, but replace heavy cream with evaporated skim milk in cheesecakes and cream pies.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to cakes, top them with fresh fruit.
Great idea.
And leave the frosting for another time,
mm-hmm.
especially maybe at this time of the year. You could say, no frosting. We'll have frosting in February.
Oh, sure. There'll be some frosting coming along down
okay.
the road.
Let's take another call. Let's go next to Normal on line four. Hi.
Hi. I just tuned in recently, and I don't know if your speaker covered this or not, but is there a relationship between vitamin deficiency and hair loss? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thanks for the question.
Well, there certainly is. I mean, for many people, if they're not getting enough nutrients overall, that can affect things like hair and skin and nails and those kinds of things. And so it's not just vitamin deficiency necessarily, but it also may be related to not enough calories, not enough protein, because protein, of course, makes these tissues as well. And so it could be any number of things. You know, sometimes people will say, well, is it just B vitamins I need to make sure I get extra B vitamins and my hair will be fine? Well, B vitamins are really good. They're helpful. They certainly help with a lot of body processes and cell development and those kinds of things. But you also have to have the calories. So occasionally I'll have people who come in and want to take a lot of B vitamins, but just really aren't eating enough to maintain good nutrition status in their body. And so you do start to see these things happening. I've certainly had clients who have, particularly years ago when fat was such a big issue. I mean, it's still, I think people have a much healthier relationship with fat now in general than we used to. But say 10, 15 years ago, when a lot of people were cutting all fat out of the diet and thinking that all fat was bad. And I had, oh gosh, 2 or 3 different clients who came in and their fat intake was so low, I don't think they were really getting many essential fats at all. And one of the problems that these ladies had was that their hair was just basically they could pull out their hair. And I think it was a combination of just no fat, essential fatty acids to help with developing tissue and repairing tissue and everything, and just not enough calories in general. When you cut your fat down that low, often you drop a lot of calories out of the diet. So you just don't have enough to eat. So I would say it's worth looking at your total diet if you're concerned about hair, skin, nails, any of those things. And maybe that would be a good time to work with a registered dietitian and do an assessment. Find out, hey, what's missing? I mean, that's the biggest thing that's helpful when you actually work with a professional, have your diet analyzed, and you can really now, what I call, kind of fine-tune what you're doing. Because if you know certain nutrients are missing or low consistently, you can work with them and try to get foods that will help. And also, if you do need supplementation, what would be appropriate?
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. Yes, I have a question regarding orange juice. I buy this not from concentrate orange juice, and I understand that that may not be any better than the made from concentrate orange juice. And I just wonder what the nutritionist has to say.
Well, one of the concerns with orange juice is, are you going to keep the vitamin C? Basically, that's one thing we drink it for, is because it's high in vitamin C. And when anything is open to air, the vitamin C levels go down because air can oxidize that vitamin pretty easily. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of things you could do. It is true that you might have read or heard something that, well, gosh, if I just buy the frozen and make a little bit at a time, that might be better because it stays frozen, it stays intact. So that's one thing that's a possibility. Or another thing you could do is buy the smaller containers of orange juice. Of course, they're more expensive per ounce, but they're not going to be exposed to air very much. And then another thing you can do to try to minimize that is just be really aware when you, a simple thing, if you have your carton of orange juice, you open the top up, you pour it out, you put the top back on right away. So, I mean, and I don't have any information to say exactly how much more vitamin C you may be preventing from oxidation, but it makes sense because a lot of times we'll pour it out and then we'll leave the carton on the counter a little bit and leave the top off. And air is going in there, right? So you could look at all those ways to enhance perhaps the vitamin C levels. But there have been studies that have indicated that, you know, the longer it's been open, the more vitamin C is, you know, not available for you. So I think I'd be aware of all those things. And then keep in mind that orange juice is a great option, and you still want to get your fresh fruits that might actually have more available nutrients.
Okay, thank you much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. What's the calorie difference between, let's say, if you wanted to get your vitamin C in an orange versus a cup of orange juice?
Well, it's about a third the calories if you actually eat the orange.
Okay.
So, plus, of course, you're getting more fiber and you're getting more full that way. So the fresh fruit, you know, many times people, if they're trying to watch their calories or get a little bit leaner, lose weight, we always say, well, fresh fruit first, because same thing with veggies, because generally the fresh has more fiber, often more fluid in the actual fruit, and is more filling than, let's say, a half a cup of orange juice.
Okay. This is Focus. Susan Kundrat is our guest this morning. We could probably take one more call this morning, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. So I guess I'll ask you one last question here. Maybe I'll get in too if we don't have a listener write in or call in. If you're hosting a get-together, what kind of beverages do you offer?
Well, I would offer a variety of beverages. I would offer something that maybe is even something like a spritzer. Let's say if you have cranberry juice with some spritzer or Diet 7-Up or something like that, which is festive, holiday, but very low calorie. So for people who really don't want many calories, that's certainly a really good option. And I would also look at whatever you're offering, if you have wine or other alcoholic beverages or other things that you're offering, I would keep the glasses relatively small, because part of the issue is people will drink a full glass of something. So if you're trying to be mindful of people trying to watch what they're taking in or how much they're taking in, have smaller options for glasses. And the other thing I would do is I would always have a pitcher of ice water available.
Great.
Because many people will drink that if it's there, too.
One last call. It'll have to be fast. Cell phone, line four. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, yes. I recently had a colonoscopy. And my doctor removed a pilot, and he told me afterwards that due to my lack of vitamin D, there's a possibility that it may come back. So what is the relation between vitamin D and colon polyps? Can you elaborate?
Well, what we've known from studies is that if vitamin D levels are low, that seems to be one of the risk factors for polyps. And again, I'm not an expert in the actual cells of the colon to see, you know, what exactly happens. But vitamin D is helpful, I know, to keep the cell integrity or the actual integrity of the colon healthy. And so that's one nutrient that if it is low, that might increase your risk of problems with the colon and certainly the polyps and things. So, but physiologically, it plays a role in keeping a healthy gut. And so that is just another main reason that everyone should, I believe, you know, get their D levels checked, because there are so many things that relate to it.
Yeah. So to go back to the physician kind of question, and also maybe it's time to consult a dietitian.
Exactly.
Or use a tool online where you can take keep a journal and figure out where you are and where you should head.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Well, I think with that we will wrap up this episode of Focus with Susan Kundrat. And Susan, we hope to see you in December. How about that?
That It'll sounds good. December we can talk 8th. About more holiday
okay.
ideas. Even.
All right. We will party on. Okay. Susan Kundrat, she is with Nutrition on the Move. She joins us once a month on the second Wednesday of the month in the 10 o'clock hour of Focus. So our next show we're shooting for, December 8th at 10 o'clock.